other yak babies. Sex, presidents, and sometimes books.
Welcome to Yak Babies, the only podcast on the internet sponsored by, I lost my sponsors.
Volcanoes?
Mescalitos. Yeah, volcanoes. They explode. Yay. My name is Aaron here and the personal pal is Dave.
Hey, boys.
And Brick.
Hello.
And calling from overseas, old Irish Nico.
Hello.
Our topic today is a book that we've talked about before that all my personal pals have read, or at least partially read, and I'm very excited to hear that because it's a great book. I loved it. I read it last summer. It's called Under the Volcano by Malcolm Lowry, and this became sort of an inadvertent story club episode. So I'm glad to hear that the person pals read it. I'm dying to hear what they thought about it. Dave, I think you're the first person to take the call to arms to read Malcolm Lowry. So why did you decide to pick up Under the Volcano?
I can't remember if I picked it up before you had finished it or while you were still in the process, but you were enjoying it so much. And I think I read it after we did the Modern Library Top 100 episode.
Right.
And that's, I believe, number 11 on that list. So, you know, it seemed like a good title.
Yeah.
To take a look at.
There was impetus to check it out.
Yeah, for sure.
I should say, Dave and I are drinking Mezcalitos in honor of the main character of Under the Volcano, Jeffrey Furman, the consul, who is an inveterate alcoholic, just like we are. So, cheers to him.
Why don't you tell the listeners why you read this book? Because I kind of like that story.
Yeah, so several episodes back in the feed, we did a EME game about famous last lines of novels, and when I was researching that, I found one of them on the list was the last line of Under Volcano, and it was a dead dog was thrown in the ravine after him or something along those lines, and I was intrigued by the line, like, how could this happen? Like, what would lead to a situation where a dead dog is being thrown after someone in a ravine? It just seemed improbable. It seemed, like, almost funny, like, how sinister and dark that ending was. So I had to figure out how it got there. Like, what led to that situation? And I had known of the novel for a while when I was a kid. In my bathroom book that we've discussed before in this podcast or sister podcast to it, it was one of the excerpted novels there, one of like the, not excerpted, abridged novels in that collection. And I never read the summary, but I just knew the title because it was there constantly. So it was in my head. So it was like, I figured I might just go ahead and just try and read it. I knew nothing about it. I knew nothing about the style. I knew nothing about Malcolm Lowry. I had no prior conceptions other than it was a book that had been made into a movie and that was about it. And so I was obviously blown away. Like I just mentioned before when I discussed it in a reading episode, it's a really breathtaking novel. It's a really complicated and hard to read, but ultimately a very rewarding experience that I was totally blown away by. I had no ideas what this book was. I understand now the cult around it. There's like a pretty substantial cult of readers who are devoted to Malcolm Lowry, this book specifically, and I totally get it. It makes as much sense to me as people who are devoted to Ulysses and James Joyce. What was your guys' experiences with that? I want to hear your thoughts on this novel.
Well, I think Ulysses and James Joyce is kind of the clear comparison.
Yeah.
It's very different from that book in a lot of ways, but also similar. I don't think he really writes much like Joyce.
Yeah.
Or at all, maybe. But structurally, it's similar. And I think thematically, it's doing, not necessarily, maybe not thematically, it's doing the same things, but sort of artistically.
Well, the whole like one day in a life thing is...
Yeah, Ulysses it takes place in that. One day, and the different chapters don't get quite as varied or experimental as they do with Ulysses.
Yeah.
But they do, the different chapters have different perspectives, and they play with forms. They're not necessarily sorted by, like, it's not like this is the chapter that does this or whatever, but
yeah.
I mean, it does in a way. There's the one chapter where the train pamphlet kind of keeps intruding, and there's one, was it written like a play? Was it?
Mm-hmm.
The one right before Hugh's chapter, something it wasn't written like it, but something happened that was, I remember it stood out to me. I'm not going to remember what it is right now.
We discussed before that maybe this sort of similarity is more Faulkner than Joyce.
Yeah.
And that it's a bit more in the plot writing. Forward. Yeah.
The prose is beautiful.
Yeah.
Really, really nice.
Yeah. How would you describe it? How would you characterize Lowry's prose style?
Modernist.
Yeah, certainly.
Sometimes, I mean, he's just really good. You know, it's one of those ones where it's kind of hard to pin down what's so great about it. It's just like sentence to sentence are great, and then they string together great, and it feels constantly cohesive and organic almost. But then there's a playfulness in there, which is really nice. And he does, I think especially, there's a couple, like when he does descriptions of the environments or the physical kind of layouts, it does a very good job of not, he sort of describes a mood. Or I think I wrote somewhere, what are they things? I wrote something to the extent of like, he does a good job of describing what the sky feels like.
Hmm, interesting.
Where like, he doesn't necessarily describe the atmosphere, but the atmosphere comes through clearly of whatever description he does offer up, which is not something you see a lot.
Right.
It's very, very good. It reminded me in that the writing style is nothing like him, but in that specific regard, it reminded me a bit of Hemingway, which is what we're talking about when we kind of landed on Faulkner, because he does something similar.
Yeah, lots of controlled detail and setting, but yeah, not Hemingway-like in terms of it's... Hemingway is so terse, and this is... It goes on.
Yeah.
It's... You could say it's overwritten, but it's not at the same time.
Right, yeah.
Dave, what are your thoughts on this? You've written this twice now. This is your second reading of this novel.
Yeah, and I wish I could have finished it in time, but boy, I really recommend to you, particularly Aaron, a second read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you read a book for the first time, it's like just kind of waiting to see how the story unfolds.
Right.
This time, knowing how the story unfolds, I can spend more time in the detail work and on, you know, the way that Lowry lays the foundation of what's to come later.
Right.
And boy,
more there's rewarding.
Some affecting stuff that I didn't really know how to, I guess, latch onto or dwell in the first time through.
Hmm. Interesting.
Some pretty crushing moments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that like character stuff, or I guess like kind of all character stuff, really? But
yeah, character stuff it's a moments.
Very
yeah.
character centric book.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has a very complicated plot, I think, for something that doesn't have a complicated plot.
Yeah, it's not really complicated.
If you were to describe it, it wouldn't be complicated, but so much of it is there's like tendrils everywhere.
Yes.
Another, the beginning of chapter 4 is like super Joycey, right? Daily Globe, Interlube, Londres Press, Collect, following yesterday's headcoming anti-Semitic campaign, Mex Press, Propetition, CT, Emma, Mex Worker, like, is it a telegram?
Telegram or Bolton or something like that, seems that way.
And there's other times where there's like press releases and weird things just kind of stuck in, they're like alongside the narrative.
Right.
There's definitely a lot of reference at work here. Not all, certainly probably fair to say not much of which I latched onto, but I don't feel like that held me back. It would have been made it richer if I were a more well-read person and understood more why he was doing all that. There were a few moments in the plot, and I think we maybe talked about how we had some of these experiences. Like there's that major scene where they come across this dead man that really... the story kind of hinges on
our dying man, right?
Didn't really understand fully what the hell was happening there.
Yeah, I think that it's a novel. We've mentioned this maybe either before or recently or in an upcoming episode that would benefit from a Norton critical edition approach where you kind of have a lot of footnotes and a lot of sort of hand holding, but only on a second or third pass. I feel like the first pass, you really shouldn't have that stuff.
Yeah.
The being overwhelmed by it and sort of being, you know, in that moment trying to figure out what actually is happening here seems to be, I don't know if not intentional, but part of the process of reading it, right? I don't think Lowry's writing is a style that really wants you to follow along clearly with every little bit. It's feeling and distress of that moment is more important than the actual sort of mechanics of it. Nico, what about you? So you are about halfway through at this point.
Yeah, I didn't, I don't think I took to it quite the same as you guys did.
Yeah.
But I think I had the same kind of experience. So,
interesting.
Like, I think it's a book that a lot of, I don't know, I've only read it once, but a lot of the first read of it is just trying to figure out what is actually happening.
Right.
I think that's a combination of potentially what he's trying to do with the prose, but also like just the style of the time, you know? So there's like, there'll be kind of like a lot of the dialogue is just somebody talking for like a page and a half. You know, and then by the end of it, you're like, who's talking?
Sure. And just as often, well, not just as often, but often it turns out that what you've been reading as dialogue is stuff that's happening internally.
Yeah, totally.
In the consoles.
Yeah, like reality gets skewed quite a few times.
Yeah.
Right. Or he there's that part where he like falls in the street and then for like three pages, he's just face down in the street. And then he's like thinking about shit, and then you get to a part where he's like he like picks himself up and it's like, oh, he's still fucking in, like face down in the street, like good god. It's just tough to, I think part of it was also like the way that I would read a book like this for a deadline is like I would give myself about a week and just like cruise through it at the end so that I still remember all the details. And this one, like, I just couldn't read Yeah.
Yeah, you really can't cruise this novel.
I had to read the first third twice because I kind of started to bounce off it a little bit the first time, and I had to go back. You really have to push it through the beginning because it's not a very welcoming opening of the book, I don't think.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice. Nico and I discussed this actually in text form before, that the opening chapter seems like a deliberate challenge the first time through, and I felt the same way. The first time through, I was like, God, what the fuck is this? And I was really lost, and I was starting to doubt myself and my reading faculties and so forth.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden, chapter two blossoms, and it really becomes something totally different. The first chapter, so Lowry rewrote this several times. This is only one draft of several, and I wonder if what we're reading is actually the intended draft, or if this is sort of a satisfying finish to the novel for Lowry.
This wasn't his last book, though.
No, but I'm sure that Lowryists will like have lots to say about the different versions of Under the Volcano and different orders and so forth. But it does seem like it's putting a sign up in front of the novel that if you can get through this, then the rest of it will kind of unfold. And there's that sense of doom that comes in that first chapter that I really do appreciate, but it takes so much to get through it.
So there was an introduction in my version by Michael Schmidt that was kind of apologetic for the first chapter. And it was like,
oh, really?
It talks about that. And it's like, there's a line in it, I can't find it, but it says something like, it's a novel that's as hard to read, like to start to read, as it was for Lowry to start to write. And it like compare, and in that, like, I didn't read even the entire introduction, but like that was enough for me to go to the Wikipedia of the book and like try to, and try to figure out what was happening. And that was the only way that I even knew that it's a year after everything else. It's weird. Yeah, it's a weird book.
It is.
Yeah. So for me, the last third of the book is really what kind of made me decide it was great.
Why the last third?
Because that's when a lot of those kind of plot tendrils become apparent.
It's when they actually leave the city and go on the bus trip.
Yeah, but you see like the creeping of fascism is pretty important, and it's sort of not noticeable in the first couple thirds of the book, and then you start seeing it. There's the thing with the dead guy, or the mostly dead guy, which is connected to that.
Yeah.
And then he's also playing around a lot more. Like, things happen out of order, and you don't realize it at first,
right?
Where suddenly the actual structure of the narrative has changed, but it's so subtle that you have to, like, you can miss that easy. I had to go back and read the last chapter again to be like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Because the final chapter and the penultimate one are inverse. And then I'm not entirely sure. I think I need to read it again. But the dead guy is connected to those cops in the end as well, right? The implication is they killed him.
Yeah. Or they're at least in on the people robbing the guy that was killed.
Right. To sort of fund whatever their kind of anti-anarchist. Right. Yeah. So feel like that stuff must go further back, and that's a bit of a payoff there. But I need to go back and find it.
Hugh talks about it.
There's a lot of anti-Semitism kind of buried in Hugh's chapters.
Yeah, a lot. Buried is generous. Like, it's kind of
some of it's pretty on the nose. Yeah. But there's also, I
mean, starting with that telegram.
Yeah.
So I want to, again, like Ulysses, like the first time through is you're learning the language.
Yes.
Right? And then you need to take those, because there's so, like, again, like there's like the train chapter, it starts playing with sounds, right? And like, what's this about? And then I wonder, and then a few chapters earlier, their servant or the waiter, whatever that guy's name is, he like literally starts talking like Dr. Seuss, Cervantes. You like eggs, stepped on eggs, moist brosa, divorced eggs for fish, sliced a fish with peas, volivant, a rain, somersaults for the queen. You like poxy eggs, poxy and toast, veal liver, tavern man, Pernerson and chike chump, or spectral chicken of the house, young chicken, red snapper. Like, he's like, the way dialogue happens changes chapter to chapter, right?
Yeah.
And then in the train chapter, the narration, it just starts doing all these weird playful things that they parallel with his state of inebriation,
right?
And that makes me feel like I probably missed a lot in the first third of the book that I need to go back to now that I have that sort of unlocked for me.
Right.
And then you probably need a third read to then reconnect those things to the end of the book.
Right.
But it was in that last third that I started to see like just how complicated it was.
Mm.
And that's what really hooked me and made me realize that this was something special.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with you in that, in the regard that the last third is where you get the most sort of complication, the most sort of like intrigue maybe. But I really was captured in the first After the first chapter...
Chapter 2, I decided I liked it and I was going to finish it.
Yeah, Chapter 2 blew me away. The whole section of Yvonne coming home and going to Jeffrey's house and seeing Hugh, that whole like setting up of their triad, kind of like their weird relationship, I was 100% involved by that point in the novel. Even the part where Nico was mentioned before, where he falls on the ground or in the street and just lays there for a while and then later on picks himself up, or the English person lives next door comes and yells at him and then tries to offer him a ride to wherever he needs to go. I love that part. Like, it's just like a weird, interesting detail, but it sold me on the detail and the sort of, I guess, the scope of how they were talking about it. It sort of felt like it was always kind of like this widescreen approach to the novel. Like, there was always this, like, so much going on to capture at once. I think I read to you guys that one sentence that goes on for a page and a half before when we first talked about it, and how that was where I was like, fuck, this novel is something. And that never gets maybe that grandiose again, but close to it. And that's where I sort of felt captured by it. What about Hugh's chapter? So the kind of the long, detailed story of Hugh's life. What did you make of that section?
That was one of the parts that I think I didn't understand.
Yeah.
And would want to read again.
Yeah. Dave, what about you?
It's been a few months and I haven't gotten there on my second reread, but it's about he's like an amateur musician for a while.
But also like works on a ship and like he's this like amateur adventurer. He's basically, it sounds like he's like a spoiled kid who tries to do a lot of stuff and wants to be remembered for his music, but ends up not being. And I don't know, it's a weird chapter.
Right. And now he's preparing to run guns to Spain now.
He's a journalist slash like mercenary or something like that.
Yeah. I feel like he's connected to the fascists or the, not the fascists, anti-fascist.
But not wholeheartedly. Like it seems like he is a dilettante in that regard, right? That's what I got from it.
What I'm wondering, and I don't know. I feel like when I go back and read it again, there's Hugh's story doesn't fit in as neatly to the rest. Like, he's mostly the foil for the love triangle.
Yeah.
But I feel like he's probably buried in this book more, and I didn't see it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I think we need to talk a little more about the ending, because Hugh disappears from the ending, and the other two don't. And then the ending is such a divergence from the structure of the rest that I feel like there's something there.
Yeah. Yeah, Hugh is lost.
Well, Hugh is looking for his brother who is actually lost. But then he just
sort of like ends up gone. Assume he ends up wandering around, whereas Yvonne and Furman both die.
Right.
Right. In connected but sort of separate tragic ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, the ending is, the pace is different, right? The pace of the ending is a totally different kind of novel. It feels more propulsive and more rhythmic, whereas the previous 400 pages are a bit more lyrical and a bit more sort of like relaxed in that regard. It feels stressful.
But it's also the last Furman, as he's dying, says, "Wow, this is a dingy way to die."
Yeah,
which is like such a weird. It's weird.
Yeah, but you've been in his head the entire time, though, right?
Yeah.
Like
I, but he says he doesn't think it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, that's interesting.
How much do you guys feel comfortable? I mean, I think all three of you feel more comfortable with this than I do. But how much do you guys feel comfortable with like a prose style that requires a lot of effort just to kind of sort out details of what's actually happening?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think that you have to, maybe you're measuring sort of what you're getting out of it, right? So there's always the question of, this applies to art too, where if you look at a painting in an art museum that is, you know, sort of like a Jackson Pollock or something like that, where it's like, oh, well, my kid could have done that, whatever, that kind of attitude. You know, how much are you investing in modernist art in terms of appreciation that comes from context and prior expectation versus the actual text itself? In this case, I feel like even though the prose style is difficult to get into, the moments of beauty that come out of it were surprising, not surprising, but also just like astounding. Like it was shocking how pretty they were and how I was swept away with them in a way that I'm not often in a lot of literature. So that was the exchange. That was the barter that I had with Valerie, which is like, I can give you this if you can get through the rest of it. And I was willing to go through 400 pages of that to get those moments, and I got them.
Yeah. And the less penetrable stuff is front loaded pretty heavily.
Yeah.
Where the book gets easier to read as you go.
Right. I mean, if a prose style such as this has that kind of a payoff, then yeah, I'll take as much time as I need with a book like this. Like, you can skip if you want, like, just like wide swaths of this book and still get the story.
Yeah, you can see the entire Hugh chapter, for instance. Like, you would have no problems with it.
But you definitely, I mean, it's definitely a different experience. It's not what I'm looking for in this book.
Yeah. Necessarily. Well, that again speaks to the fact that it was, this is just a different draft of the ultimate novel, right? That we, whatever Lowry's intended, he obviously was playing with the order and sort of the expression of it too. So there's something, he has some thoughts about what you should be consuming first and second as well, and what's worth it and what's not. But I agree with, I mean, Nico, without that sort of reward or exchange, then it's definitely challenging.
And you got to find it yourself, right? Like,
yeah.
I had to read the beginning twice. I might not have if we weren't reading this together.
Hmm. Really?
Right.
It might have been one of those books where I put it down for 2 weeks and I wasn't going back.
Right.
And that's a shame because I would have missed out because I really liked it.
I mean, right. It's a question of whether you're at the present moment looking for a challenge, and then if you start the book and it is challenging, is this the book that you want to challenge you? Like, is this how you want to?
Right. You want to spend your time, basically. Right. Yeah. And I mean, I wouldn't look down on, if Brick had not read it, I wouldn't be like, oh, you're an idiot. Like, I totally get it. I felt kind of the same way where I was like, fuck, what is this? But I kept going for whatever reason. But it's not a book that invites you to read it. It puts up barriers to make you want to read it.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. I want to read Amazon review that I found that I thought was really funny. This is Amazon user review. The user is Kirby. This is a 1-star review for Amazon. Subject is "Let the Volcano Explode, Please." And I'll let you listen and you can tell me what you think of it later on. So it says this: Malcolm Lowry edited, possibly even rewrote sections of this book 10 years after he'd originally wrote it. And it shows uncountable typos as well as clusters of words that make no sense at all when put together. Even a page and a half long sentence. I had a hard time even picking this book up again because of the grammar, spelled with an E-R. Shame on the editor. Convolutedness to the extreme. The book did offer some insight into the mind of an alcoholic. Jeffrey Furman lost the most beautiful thing he could ever have in his whole miserable life. Unconditional love. Every time he had to look reality in the face, as well as commitment, he dove into the bottle. Yvonne, his estranged wife, wanting only his love, returns to him, hoping to rekindle their love. Even though she declares her undying love for him, it becomes complicated when Furman's brother Hugh shows up. There are subtle suggestions that Yvonne and Hugh were romantically involved while she was stateside. She and Hugh spend a little time together, while Furman spends his within the walls of a bottle. Then the one day the book revolves around is a Day of the Dead dedicated to the little area of Mexico for mourners in a melancholy setting to pay respect to the dead. The three of them set out on a short bus journey to rejoin the festivities. While traveling, they pass a dying Indian man lying on the side of the road. Wanting to help him, but warned not to touch him, they return to their bus only to discover that one of the passengers has robbed the dying man. They arrive at the destination and attend a rodeo-type bullfight. When the bulls, as well as the riders, were sad and disappointing, it's at this point that Hugh jumps in the bull ring and gives the crowd the ride of a lifetime. Seeing his brother taking the spotlight, Furman turns to the drink. It's my impression that Jeffrey Furman, being the older brother, sees himself as a failure. He's constantly walking the shadows of Hugh's success, possibly the root cause of his addiction. Afterwards, they go to a restaurant, where a political argument ignites between Hugh and Jeffrey, sending Furman into anger out in the streets, leaving Hugh and Yvonne behind. It's literally hours before she and Hugh set out to look for Furman, who by this time is sitting in a small bar, surrounded by drunken police. Who mistake Jeffrey for Hugh. Ominous to Furman, his brother is wanted for murder, and Furman meets his own demise to his brother's identity. In the meantime, Hugh and Yvonne have decided to go after Furman, walking along a mountainous path. Yvonne meets the Reaper, although also through a mysterious horse trampling. You're left to wonder about Huge, spelled H-U-G-E. Throughout the book, the appearance of the mysterious horse with a branded 7 on its haunch. It's appeared to Hugh and Yvonne while they were riding to Furman in a field while he was in the garden, at the side of the road with a dying Indian man, on the mountain when Yvonne was trampled, and yet again outside the bar when Furman died. Obviously, symbolic of impending death. There are a few good twists in this book, and it does cause you to examine and question the lives of these people, but it was a truly disappointing read. Not quite utter nonsense, but close. It gets a 1-star for effort. I love that review is like, yeah, gets it. Like, 100% is like pretty much on the nose. Not only with the plot, but also the themes of the novel. It was like 1-star for how bad this is, but completely understood exactly what it's trying to accomplish. Really odd. Yeah. The last line of there are a few good twists in the book, but it causes you to imagine, to examine and question the lives of three people is like, yeah, right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's bizarre.
1-star to completely get the point, and then just like, yeah.
Is that true that they killed him because they thought he was Hugh?
I wasn't sure about that.
Because I didn't get that, but that would be interesting if that were true.
I think it is true, but I wasn't totally sure.
They ask him if he's a Jew. They seem to understand that he's a consul.
Yeah, I thought so, right?
And then they call him a spider and ruining his country and, you know, and they confuse him for an anarchist.
Right.
Right, because spider is spy.
Right.
Right. In the world of the book.
Right.
And I think I read somewhere, unless it comes from the prose itself, that consul often was like a synonym for spy.
Oh, right.
In this.
Yeah. I think you're right about that. Yeah. Right.
I thought it was kind of assumed that they were spies because they were English or whatever.
Right.
Like it was an official title, but
yeah,
a lot of consuls were acting as spies.
Right.
I don't know. I feel like I don't fully understand Hugh's role in this book. I understand his role in the relationships of the characters.
Yeah.
But I feel like he's got a bigger role in the book. I just don't know what it is. And that also might be me looking for something that's not there. I understand that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think the relationship aspect is the most important part of Hugh's role there, is to be the spoiler for he and Yvonne, and to be sort of this accompanying figure where he's both helping Jeffrey sort of stay alive, but also is like a figure of annoyance or frustration for him. Mm. He's a cucking vermin, or at least seemed to be.
Yeah, he definitely is.
Yeah.
You guys think of this backstory, or this potential thing that from Jeffrey's past, where in the First World War...
Or like murder Germans on a U-boat?
Yeah. Yeah. Like he was captaining a boat and threw the German officers from the captured boat into the furnace, or had people do it for him.
Yeah.
But then it didn't become clear to me, at least, whether we're supposed to know whether this actually happened or whether it was just a rumor that, because he was court-martialed for it, but he got off.
Right.
And then he got this award. And
right.
He seems to imply sometimes in his sort of drunken narration that it really did happen. But then there's also a moment where Yvonne says that it didn't happen. And
right.
Like it's hard to know what to believe there. And
yeah.
Because if it did happen, then, you know, there's maybe another answer why he's the way he is.
Yeah, totally. My reading was that it was real.
Me too.
And that Yvonne's denial was either naivete or like a willingness to try and see him as a good character or as a noble man, you know, aside of his obvious faults. And that the fact that he was drunkenly lamenting his responsibility was a sign of like guilt or shame in some regard, right? Which makes the consul like... harder to swallow as a person. It was like he's like a fucking like war criminal, essentially.
It's not a war crime when you do it against a Nazi, though.
Or they're not Nazis, though.
Pre-Nazi. Pre-Nazi. Hessian.
Yeah, right. But yeah, it's what Brigg is talking about. There's this political reality to the novel that takes a bit more unpacking. And that's a part of it, too, I think, right? Yeah. Is that sort of sense of, you know, what's at stake here? What does it mean to be responsible for those things? Mm. And Hugh, I think, ties in that as well. But not as clearly, not as obviously.
So, I mean, there's the sort of world political aspect of it with sort of fascism and anarchists. But then there's also the Mexico one, which I have far less sort of ability to unpack because I don't know it. You know, and look, when I read Ulysses, there's whole books that it's just books of footnotes
right.
to help you unpack it. And I don't know if that exists for this or not. I have no idea, but probably not.
It seems like there's so much there. It seems like there's probably somebody out there.
It's probably something that exists on the internet, but I
think the guy who wrote that afterword for this has a book on this book.
William Vollman?
David Markson does. That's what I'm thinking of.
But there's so much going on that I think probably I didn't even see because I don't know what to look for, you know?
Right.
Like you got the sunglasses on that covers that color up.
Right.
With the class structures in Mexico. And, you know, I mean, obviously it's a little easier to figure out the stuff with the Indians. But even then, like the whole thing with the dead guy, they couldn't touch him because of those weird Good Samaritan laws, right?
Right.
So where you could implicate yourself in the crime if you touch a body, which is, that's got to be something that's targeting a certain population, right?
Right.
Of looting or whatever. There's a lot going on that maybe people were more aware of in the 30s. I have no idea. Maybe not.
Right.
But I'm not aware of them. And I feel like they are maybe necessary to really understand fully the themes that he's working with here.
Right. There's a documentary we should watch called Inquiry into the Death of Malcolm Lowry, right? I think we should try and find that and watch it because it's supposed to be really good. I think it was nominated for an Oscar, but might address some of our questions and give us more information. Listener, last thoughts on the volcano? Anyone want to offer anything? Or
No, I just thought the ending was really good.
Yeah, the ending is very good. I mean, as far as last lines go, pretty memorable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Listeners, tell us about your experience on the volcano on Twitter. Are you going to read it? Have you read it? Do you want to read it? All of that. YakBabies and on Twitter. And then email us at yakbabiespodcast@gmail.com with more information on the volcano. You can find us on Patreon as well, patreon.com/yakbabies. And there's things going on there that are not as, you know, not as literate maybe as under the volcano discussions going on, but still good and worth checking out for $1 a month.
Lots of Gary Shandling talk over there.
My God.
Learn the things Aaron would do to clear his good name.
To learn more about that, it will cost you $1 a month. Until then, Yak Babies, yakking off.
The Yak Babies wish to thank all the personal pals who listen each week, and most especially to send extra thanks to all who have supported on Patreon past and present, including Michael, Bonnie, Sebastian, and William Howard Taft.